Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Today we bring you a preview of the new London Design Museum. The architect John Pawson and Alice Black, the museum's deputy director, give me a tour around the as yet unopened new building.
We make design decisions every day, whether we decide to upgrade our phones every 6 months or buy a new car. We are active agents of the design process.
Next up,
there's no point coming to Singapore, stay in a warehouse hotel that feels like London. So we wanted to make it distinctly Singaporean.
We head to Singapore. The show's regular presenter, Josh Fennett, has just returned from a visit to the city-state. He'll update me on his trip, and we'll hear an interview he did with Chris Lee, the head of design firm Asylum. And we'll end the show in Japan. Our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, takes a tour of British architect Eric Parry's latest project, the Westminster Nanpai Dai in the city's Shibuya district. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Now, London's design fans are waiting with bated breath. The city's design museum is just about to open the doors of its brand new building on November the 24th. It's a significant expansion for the institution, which is moving from its previous site in a former banana warehouse in Shad Thames to the Grade 2 listed former Commonwealth Institute building in Kensington. The building, which has been unoccupied for a decade, has been renovated by a design team led by British architect John Pawson. I was lucky enough to be given a tour of the museum by John and the museum's deputy director, Alice Black. The finishing touches were still being made ahead of a royal visit by the Duke of Edinburgh.
This is the old Commonwealth Institute, which had a lot of amazing features, the main one of which was the hyperbolic paraboloid roof, which kind of soars above you. And it was my idea, or my intention, and I think everyone's, was to keep a very, very clear view of that. So when you walked in the space, way above you was this soaring roof.
We wanted to retain this sense of awe when you walk into the building and have enough space in this atrium so that people can take in this beautiful view, the scale of the building, the scale of the roof which arches above your head. John did a fantastic job in creating that and allowing people to really get a sense of this space and of the special nature of this roof. As you enter, you're confronted with this beautiful staircase, oak staircase. One thing we decided to do with John was to make this staircase partly a staircase that you can sit on. Again, to have this welcome to visitors as they come into the building. And it's just embodied throughout the museum. There's plenty of sitting places. And this, to me, very much shows the key value of the museum, which is one of welcoming visitors to be with us.
I mean, even though it's a vast space, I think it feels intimate when you come in. And one of the briefs to myself is to make buildings in which people feel comfortable. An architectural designer's job is really to understand people's needs and try and design around that.
We're now on the first floor of the atrium, right by the Swarovski Foundation Center for Learning, which is where we're going to do a lot of activities for school children, for university students, for adult learners. We have a very big program. And you can see, again, we're surrounded by this beautiful oak that has a very blonde hue and softens the building around us. And particularly when you look to the roof and the hard concrete, it's a wonderful play on materiality.
It's not just about a building for objects. It's about a building for people to be in and to feel in the right kind of mood to think about design. I mean, first they collect themselves and then they have a chance to think about what design is or go off and see the exhibition or take a break. It's important, I think, to think about people as well as objects.
So this level, you've got this big exhibition, which is our permanent display called Designer Maker User, where we introduce visitors to what design is. So this is really intended at those who don't know very much about design, who are not professional, they have no training, but they might be interested because design is around us everywhere, from the spoon to the city, as Ernesto Rogers said. So we look at it from the angles of what does the designer do? What does the maker or manufacturer do? But also very much, what is our role in this trial? Because we have a very important role. We make design decisions every day, whether we decide to upgrade our phones every 6 months or buy a new car. We are active agents of the design process. So we look at this in this display, designer, maker, user. Let's walk to the crowdsourced wall, because I think that's a very exciting element of the display. This is where we decided to turn the table and ask our audiences, what did they want to see in a design museum? So back in May, we had sent a brief to our visitors, both our visitors and also through our social media, to say to them, what are the objects that you would like to see in a design museum and why? And we received 850 nominations from objects from around the world. We've selected 250 that are here on display, not behind a glass case, but they're very much there for you. You can get very close and you will find a multitude of objects, from the flying pigeon, which is the most used bike in the world because it's the national bike of China. You will find also the London Tube logo, the roundel. It was nominated by Mayor Sadiq Khan. You will find the potato peeler from World War II.
And the marigolds.
Yes. The marigold gloves that we use. You will find also the St. James's Bible. Why? Because it is the most printed book in the world. And people have nominated objects that are either beautiful, that they find beautiful, that just bring about memories, wonderful memories for them, or for them are really exemplars of good design. So this is one way in which we've tried to make our exhibition more responsive to what people want. And really the guiding principle in our exhibitions throughout the museum is to be relevant, is to be talking to our audiences about the things that they care about. And that's why you have this crowdsourced wall at the entrance of our display, designer, maker, user.
What does the design museum visitor look like? And is that person the same person as in the old museum?
Good question. So I can tell you that in our previous museum, the typical museum visitor was younger than in other museums, typically 25, 30-year-old. They were highly connected, so very active on social media and very much interacting with us on social media. We have about 2 or 3 million followers on Twitter, which is the biggest number of followers of any museum in the world. They were male or female, much more ethnically diverse than in other museums. What the new typical visitor is going to be, I don't know. I do expect that our core of visitors who've been with us for the last 26 years are going to still stay with us and come here to Kensington to enjoy all the additional exhibitions that we have here on offer. But I'm sure there's going to be a different mix, and perhaps we'll be able to also open up to an older population. Having this diversity of visitors is really important to us, and that's why we try in our display to be as broad and as inclusive as we can.
What is the Design Museum's brand, and how does this building reflect that?
It is a younger and cooler brand than I think most museums, definitely. We want to have our finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world today. The Design Museum is about today, it's about the future, it's about asking important questions and giving people the tools to come up with their own answers. I can't wait to open the doors of the museum to the public to see what their reaction is.
That was Alice Black there, the Deputy Director of the Design Museum in London, and John Pawson, the architect who designed the museum's new premise. And joining me in the studio now, after a fortnight away in Singapore, we're happy to have him back, it's Josh Fenner. Josh, how are you?
I'm absolutely extremely well. It's very hard to adjust to the temperature. Not only the difference between London and Singapore, obviously Singapore's very balmy this time of year, but Studio One here at Midori House. Absolutely freezing. What's been going on here?
I think we're having ongoing technical difficulties with regards to the AC system, but I'll fix that.
I'd say the AC is working too well, if anything. It's too efficient.
Doing more than its fair share. We're going to move on to talking about some of your experiences in Singapore in a minute, Josh. But to begin with, I want to talk a little bit about this new design museum. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I wrote a column for, I think, the September issue of Monocle magazine in the design pages, saying that despite the terrible turn, that I think there is a consensus that Brexit is a badly organised, perhaps ill-judged move, which is playing out in the political sphere. But in the design sphere, London is doing much to stake its credentials as an international city that people should visit for ideas, where business is done. And the Design Museum is one of these takes on it. So John Pawson's an incredibly talented UK architect, spent a lot of time in Japan, and using him and his kind of very minimal aesthetic is a brilliant move. And I think the premises can advance the case for design in our city, and is one of a number of things that's making London and keeping London a vibrant place within the scene. What did you think when you walked around it? Because the recorded interview is obviously one way, but now you're away from your minders, as I'll call them, the people making sure that you weren't stealing anything. What were your impressions?
Well, first of all, I did actually manage to sneak some goodies out from the shop.
What did you get? Pawson's phone?
It was a double-ended pencil, I think, actually. But in light of what you just said, one of the most interesting things that I was shown by Alice, deputy director, was the first major exhibition that they're putting on there. It's called Fear and Love. It's curated by Justin McGuirk. I think it's McGuirk. One of the first things that you see when you walk in there is a commission by Rem Koolhaas's practice OMA. And it's called the Pan-European Living Room. And it's a living room containing, it's furnished with items from all 28 EU member states. And then the curtain is a blind made up of the flags of all the members of the EU, with one of them, that of Britain, having fallen down, lying across the floor, revealing behind it a glimpse of a blown-up picture of Rotterdam destroyed by bombing. This is obviously an explicitly political piece, a pretty stark critique of Brexit. And I asked Alice, it's interesting, many organisations, cultural organisations, museums would bend over backwards to try to remain neutral, I think, particularly, you know, at the centre of London, moving into a very visible tier of London attractions as they are. But they're very happy to kind of strike out and be assertive about at least hosting design exhibitions which take an explicit stand on these issues. And I thought that was an engagingly strident approach on the part of the curatorial team there, something that I appreciate.
Yeah, completely. And it's the job of these museums to test our reactions and to push us in certain directions and to challenge our preconceptions. There's no point in a museum showing you things you already know or exposing you to emotions that you already feel and being an echo chamber for things that people already think. So that's excellent news. And the role of the museum in London, even with Martin Roth, the former director of the V&A, quitting in the wake of Brexit, I think the museums in the city are in rude health and spoiling for a bit of a fight in defence of a liberal ideal about discussing things rather than closing doors on things, which I think, you know, we're being a bit political here, but I think it's our broad liberal internationalist consensus that, you know, Brexit and such things are a bad thing. But are we turning our attention to warmer climes, Henry?
I think we should, Josh. You've just come back from a warmer clime, Singapore. How was it? What did you see? What did you do?
Well, it's a bit of an exploration of the Singapore design scene while I was there. Manning Monocle's Singapore Bureau. We did a special a few weeks ago in which we talked to some great architects. We talked to Jason Pomeroy setting out the lay of the land in Singapore, which I would argue is an amazing case study for urbanists, for architectures, for designers. And as a city, it's extremely densely populated. But because it has an authoritarian government, a mild and pretty meek authoritarian government, but one nonetheless, projects and architecture are able to happen with extreme velocity. And Singapore also, you know, architecturally is interesting because it has these amazing high-rises with green sky gardens that are commissioned at a, you know, very fast pace compared to the endless consultations you'd need in New York or London. But I also see an upwelling of Singaporean identity. So obviously, it's a British-speaking island nation. It's been independent for, I think, 51 years now. But during that time, people were often encouraged to pursue things, you know, economic careers in finance, safe careers, to wear a shirt and a tie to work and, you know, work very hard and be competitive. But the design industry, which probably, it wouldn't be rude to say 25 years ago, might have been seen as a sort of dropout industry, is actually advancing at quite the pace. So I hooked up a number of interviews, which we'll hear over the next few weeks. The interview that we're going to play next was with a very insightful man called Chris Lee, who's the founder and principal of Asylum, which started out as a graphics studio but has blossomed into a rather wonderful interiors practice. So I took the trip, Henry, to Geylang. Do you know what Geylang in Singapore is famous for?
Pray tell, Josh, I don't.
Prostitutes, actually. It's the red light district. So we visited a wonderful studio, which is a shop house in Geylang, the red light district of Singapore. And I spoke to Chris Lee about a new project that they're working on, an amazing boutique hotel called the Warehouse Hotel, which opens this December. 38 rooms, much smaller than the big box offerings that look like they've been shipped whole from New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo. It's a uniquely Singaporean owned and designed experience. And I wanted to get a bit of an insight into how he made the space and how to design hospitality in Singapore.
Some of the key branding projects would be in the National Gallery, which is like, you know, the most important museum that we opened last year. And then there are a lot of hotels that we work with, like, for example, the Warehouse Hotel, where we do both the branding and the interior design. And that is where the magic happens, where we really work as a collaborative team and we find what is the best solution, you know, be it space or be it brand, and how it comes together.
So I think the kind of hotel manager for the Warehouse Hotel might be from the US, but almost everyone else in that project is Singaporean. The owners, Lo and Behold Group, I think the man that actually owns the whole hotel as well, the backer. What does it mean? What is a Singaporean kind of visual identity? And what have you tried to do with that warehouse project, this 37-room hotel in a beautiful old factory by the Singapore River, Robertson Quay? Yeah. What makes that uniquely Singaporean, and what did you try and do with the space?
I think we obviously went to do a lot of research, and given that it is a godown, we call it a godown, which is like a warehouse, and they used to store spices. And obviously, there was also a lot of illicit activities we found that were during the heydays, and we tried to bring a bit of that excitement into that space. And to be honest, Singapore is, you know, like any other cosmopolitan city today, is very modern, but it's a bit lacking in heritage, we feel. So we try to bring a bit of that heritage into the warehouse. And so you will see elements like, for example, the branding. If you go into see the amenities, the kids are all in Mandarin and written in that old font and that old kind of layout that you have. So you bring a bit of the heritage into that space. I think people, when they travel today, they want to take a bit of a piece of a history with them. I mean, there's no point coming to Singapore, stay in a warehouse hotel that feels like London. So we wanted to make it distinctly Singaporean.
So what kind of decisions did you make to program the space to make people feel like that? If for people that won't have seen it, it's got three pitched roofs, a very distinctive silhouette, a large atrium when you walk in, and the rooms kind of around it. But how do you go about selecting what furniture, what colours, what textures? What were the ways in which you wanted to tell this story about Singaporean design and hospitality?
I think one of the key ideas was initially when I first looked at the place, I think it's quite easy to repurpose it and make it quite cool. But at the same time, if you look at industrial warehouses in every part of the world and how they've done hotel quite beautifully already. So I took on to do a futuristic projection of that space, and I was very inspired by this old movie called Metropolis, a German movie. And I wanted to create this futuristic setting where when you walk into the warehouse, you get a big surprise because it's not what you expect in there. And I mean, if you look at what is really local, the restaurant will be a key example of how you eat a popiah restaurant. You can't find a popiah restaurant anywhere outside of Singapore. It's like kind of a very convivial kind of communal dining where you use your hands to roll a spring roll and then you eat them. So we kind of program it so that the experience is what you can only get in Singapore, I guess.
And did you struggle? I mean, Singapore is not a resource-rich island, and there's not a tremendous amount of manufacturing or craft that has been able to stay here. So when it came to the fixtures and fittings, when it came to making it feel Singaporean, was that a problem, or and how did you get around it? How did you source the things that went into the room that felt like they were, as you said, not from London, but uniquely Singaporean?
I think a lot of the key fixtures are all designed by us. So if you go into a room, for example, the closet together with the pantry table together is all integrated into that space. So we design one single frame that houses the whole thing, and that design will be very unique to only this hotel. In parts of the hotel where we try to create the elements of the go down, where the warehouse, so the lightings were like the pulley wheels and all that stuff. I mean, to be honest, it is tough for us to find craftsmen in Singapore. So our contractors have to do that job, and we always, you know, make them do a lot of mock-ups and until, you know, we get the kind of quality that we want. But it is a big problem in Singapore to find like kind of original craftsmen who has been doing things for a long time and asking them to repurpose what they do for us.
And as the principal and founder of this studio, do you find the same thing with Singaporean talent? Do people always want to stay here? I'm thinking of young designers, young typographers, young people working in the graphics and creative industry. Does Singapore feel like an exciting, optimistic and upswinging place at the moment to you?
I think when we started 15 years ago, you can't find anybody outside of Singapore who wants to work in Singapore. Nobody wants to work here because it's kind of noted to be a sterile environment. But today, like, half our studios are international, and people really don't mind coming to Singapore to live for like 2-3 years. So we get this influx of talent, which makes, you know, the work exciting, which makes the culture exciting. When you look at the kind of work that we produce, it is showing, I think.
When you work on a project like the Warehouse Hotel, I mean, it's fairly obvious that it's for Singaporeans, but it's also for visitors from other places. How do you balance what a local expectation would be compared to a visiting Russian or a visiting Chinese person or a visiting someone from the west coast of the US? Is there any compromise you have to make, or is there today a global traveller that will acknowledge these things?
I think as you walk into the space, immediately you would see it being transformed, and I think that surprise element would, you know, is something where we want everybody to feel it. And then if you're a person from another culture or city, when you look into the details, whether it be the coasters, be it the notebooks, or if you stay in a room, the amenities, you will then feel that it's distinctly local. So there are, I think there's several levels of design in that space that allows everybody to take something out of it.
It's nearly time to say goodbye, but before we do, here's a report from Japan. The British architect Eric Parry has a strong reputation for beautifully crafted, high-quality contemporary work. It ranges from the refurbishment of St Martin in the Fields in London's Trafalgar Square to the spa at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Hyde Park. His studio's latest project is a renovation and redesign of a 52-unit apartment block in Tokyo's Shibuya district. The Westminster Nanpai Dai is part of the property portfolio of the Grosvenor Estate. The project saw Parry working with a group of top Japanese craftsmen. They included an expert traditional plasterer, a stone artist, and a lighting designer. Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson met Parry for a tour of the residence.
Now we've moved through the entrance lobby and find ourselves at reception. One has to imagine this was external, so it's extraordinary in terms of the way it's moved to interior, laying down this light granite stone, warm granite stone for the floor, and using travertine behind the metalwork. And actually the lighting on the reception desk just gives a clue to the way that the lighting works on the building outside by night. And then these piers and openings are part of the original building, but we've created a glazed membrane, as it were, between what was a cutting. So we're picking up very much the original scheme, which had a wall. It wasn't, I think, of any particular merit, except that it has the breaking and the watercourse running through, which then finds its way through the building, which is what I was hoping to be able to connect to on the outside.
So now we've actually stepped outside and we're standing in front of this beautiful stone garden. I think it could only be in Japan that this kind of garden would be created.
Definitely, absolutely. It's unashamedly and absolutely Japanese rather than anything to do with a European tradition, both because of where it is and the context, but because of the plants, because of the stones, and indeed because of the earth wall.
And also, you know, people who are living in the building, they look onto this space, which is, you know, it must be wonderful. I'm dying to see it at night. I think it must look wonderful at night.
Yeah, well, you get an idea of that from the film we made, actually. You can see that quality and obviously to experience it even better. But one of the things, like so many of these courtyards, is that you've got dual aspect units. So you've got a series of bedrooms here, as well as the communication vertically of the stairs and so on. So this wall had behind it a fairly brutal kind of louvering that was meant to create privacy. So the layering of the landscape back to the wonderful earth wall and then the bamboo behind that has transformed something that was just hideously hard and predictable into something that allows you to dream on.
It's fantastic in a way that they decided to repurpose rather than demolish, because you know, as you know, in Tokyo they will demolish a building at the drop of a hat, you know, even a perfectly good one. So was there any discussion about demolition, or was it always going to be?
It was always going to be. The ambition was to transform rather than to eradicate, and I think that's been really good. I mean, it's actually, in that sense, I think it's a kind of a paradigm that can be followed many times.
Well, now we're actually going to go inside an apartment, which is exciting. Now we've seen the outside, the public spaces, and wow, nice start.
So, yes, we tried to expand the entrance sequence because it tends to be very small. So rather than a corridor, it's worked so that this is a lacquer panel that surrounds the guest toilet, and with its reflective surfaces, it just sort of expands this. And obviously this stone floor, which is like a very rich travertine. And then beyond that, it's a small unit. So the issue with these units is often the low ceiling height, trying to raise the ceiling and what is a very constrained height that one is given. So that's the secret of this space. And then we'll see how there's a twisting and a turning around bathroom, bedroom and living room in terms of just really struggling with the constraints of the given floor to ceiling heights and so on.
Oh, it's interesting coming inside. You know, every Japanese apartment has a genkan, this area when you come through the door where you take off your shoes. And I mean, in a way, the stone works beautifully, doesn't it, for that?
Yes, I think. Well, there's the combination of the stone for the common territory, the entrance. It's like a threshold stone that you would have in a ryokan, but it's spread further and wider. And then one moves into the timber floors for the sort of rooms of seating or sleeping.
So we've come up here to the roof garden, which is quite surprising. Fantastic views around. I can see straight to Shibuya over there. So what's the plan for this space?
Well, I think it's got a way to go, but it's started, and it is remarkable. I mean, nothing new in Tokyo or Japan to have a roof garden. So I think there's lots to learn, and in a way, the care that's been lavished on the ground will, I hope, find its way here eventually. But it is an amazing facility, really, to have this garden in the air, because actually, like a lot of traditional Tokyo, it's quite low, so we get the gardens around the building and the mature trees, which is just fantastic, magnificent. And yeah, relatively speaking, it is a very open horizon.
That was architect Eric Parry giving Monocle's Fiona Wilson a tour around the Westminster Nanpai Dai in Tokyo. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a line. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you get the chance. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan, and until next time, it's goodbye from me.